Hello, and welcome to the 11th episode of Pop Art, the podcast where I ask my guests to choose a movie from pop culture, and I choose a film from the more art classic side of cinema. I am big, it's the pictures that got small, host, screenwriter, and script consultant Howard Kasner. For those listening, please follow and like my podcast, and feel free to comment. Today, my guest is filmmaker Josh Kim, who has chosen the whimsical, idiosyncratic movie Adaptation, written by Charles Kaufman and his twin brother, Donald, while I chose the Billy Wilder film noir classic, Sunset Boulevard. To begin, Josh, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes. Hey, Howard. I am Korean-American. My parents were born in Korea, and then they immigrated here, and I was born in Texas. I've been making films since 2005. During that time, I've made one feature film called How to Win at Checkers Every Time. We shot it in Thailand, and now I'm working on my second one.
Can we mention that How to Lose at Checkers Every Time was the Thai entry for the best foreign language film of that year?
Yes, we're really lucky. And you also helped consult on that. Thank you so much. I think you were the first script consultant I had worked with, and the experience was just so great. Thank you for the advice on that.
I appreciate hearing that, but I think it's a really big deal to be the Thai entry, and it's a really good film, so I did want to mention that. So your choice was the film Adaptation. First, I will offer some information on Adaptation. Adaptation was released in 2002. It was directed by Spike Jonze. It was written by Charlie Kaufman and David Kaufman. Spoiler alert, there is no David Kaufman. He's a fictional character created by Charlie Kaufman. It's based on the book The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. It stars Nicolas Cage, Meryl Streep, Chris Cooper, Kara Seymour, Brian Cox, Tilda Swinton, Maggie Gyllenhaal, Ron Livingston, and as themselves, John Malkovich, John Cusack, Catherine Keener, Lance Acord, and Spike Jonze. The basic premise revolves around a fictionalized Charles Kaufman, a self-loathing, shy, socially awkward screenwriter who was hired to adapt a book into a screenplay. But the book is impossible to adapt because it has absolutely no plot or structure. So he eventually has to reach out to his twin brother, his total opposite, for help. To begin, why did you choose this movie?
I just, in the back of my mind, I remember that this was a really good film. I hadn't seen it since college, and my roommate had recommended it. I think I remember that time. That was a time when, like, Napster was around, and as soon as you got into college, in the college, like, intranet, I remember just downloading a whole bunch of movies. I think, actually, college is when I started to really fall in love with movies. That's when I really started to watch all different kinds of movies, and directors like Tom Tykwer, Run Lola Run, and The Princess and the Warrior. I remember those. I just remember it being a really good film, and I hadn't seen it since then, and I wanted to watch it again. And when I rewatched it, it was really good. One thing I remember about the movie, one line was something about how he loved someone else, and someone was telling the main character, but she doesn't love you. And then in the movie, the line was, you know, that love is mine. I owned it. I can love whoever I want. And I remember that being really powerful. I wrote down him saying, that was her business, not mine. You know, you are what you love and not what loves you. And I thought it was just really cool about how it was a film about a film. Now, being a screenwriter, I felt like the process of him writing that film, I thought it was really interesting about adapting. I've worked on two adaptations now, the Thai film, and now adapting a Chinese film based on short stories. It was interesting to see that after so many years of not having seen it.
Do you think it still holds up?
I do. The only thing that kind of, like, made me cringe was the portrayal of the Native Americans, of, like, them doing drugs, that they barely even speak. That's the only thing. Otherwise, I felt it held up really well. I thought Tilda Swinton, she was amazing as the studio executive.
Tilda Swinton? I don't know her exact title, but yes, she represented the studio, and she was probably be a producer.
I thought the acting was really great. I mean, the last third act, he kind of says what the last third act has to do, and then he goes and does it. And it kind of reminded me of, like, Little Women. Just kind of meta about her having that conversation with the book publisher wanting a happy ending, and this is how she writes it. Yeah, I've been in a lot of meetings like that, where the studio execs want a happy ending, want the ending to be positive, and women want that Hollywood ending. So I kind of relate to their plight.
That's very interesting. Never thought about the comparison to Little Women, but I think that's very true. So you say you identify with the screenwriter in the movie.
Well, I mean, I think there are some lines. I mean, he talks to himself a lot, and he's like, okay, so I need to establish theme. And it's like, oh, you know, while he's writing, he's like, maybe banana nut, you know, maybe for breakfast, I'll get a muffin. Yeah, that's a good muffin. And I don't know, this stream of consciousness, I can relate to that. I don't know, I guess also the schizophrenic kind of personality that he has with his twin brother, I can relate to that as well. So, I mean, I think he did that really well.
I first saw it when it came out in 2002, of course, when I was going to movies on a regular basis. And I very much enjoyed it. I'm not a real big Nicolas Cage fan myself. I tend to only like him when he does normal people things. So I like him in things like Leaving Las Vegas, It Should Happen to You, and almost never like him when he goes over the top, though I did like him in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans. But overall, I very much enjoyed the film. One of the things I found interesting about it, and I especially felt this second time around, is it is, to me, in many ways, a huge commentary on screenwriting and how screenplays get written. One of the things I noticed at the end is that by the time the movie is over, he has employed everything that Robert McKee says he needs to do that he doesn't think he should do.
Yes.
And he also breaks every single one of his own rules as well, while at the same time presenting a very idiosyncratic and original and unique screenplay out of it. For one thing, McKee says, don't use voiceover. And of course, he uses voiceover throughout the whole thing. McKee says, don't have a deus ex machina. But then you have the alligator at the very end jump out of nowhere and get LaRouche. He doesn't want to put a traditional plot to the story, which he finally does by the end with the big chase. And McKee says, you know, you need a big third act. It doesn't matter what else happens as long as you have a big third act. So he gives this big third act. And he says he wants to write a film in which people don't change, in which people don't learn, in which there aren't lessons there. Because that's what life is like. And then at the end, and you quoted it, he says, well, I learned that love is who you love. And he presents these themes that he or he would never, never, never do.
How do you think it do you think it holds up over time? What do you think?
I think it's still as enjoyable as it ever was. In some ways, I'm going, you can't do what you want to do. I know that you can't do what you want to do. You've taken a book that has no plot. And at the same time, by trying to put a plot into it, you're going to rob it of everything maybe that it has. When Saturday Night Live was made, it was based on an article in a magazine about people who went to discos and spent their weekends dancing. But there was no plot. There's no central character. There is no real conflict. So they created this artificial conflict and this artificial plot. It's a very enjoyable movie. It's not a particularly good one, but it made a lot of money. So
which movie?
Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, okay, okay.
I probably said Saturday Night Live, but I meant
Saturday. You did. You did.
I meant Saturday Night Fever. And the same for things like Fame, which is let's make a movie about this high school for the performing arts. There's no plot. There's no conflict. There's no arc, but we'll make one up. And you get a very successful and very entertaining movie out of it. But it's not a particularly great movie. It's just a good movie. So I do think in a way it's a very interesting commentary on screenwriting and how one makes a movie.
And Spectrum is just a great director. There's just small details of like, I think his brother's bed doesn't even have sheets on it, you know, and I think that tells you about his character. But also when, who is it? Was it Meryl Streep when she just first tries the drug and she's like in her bathroom in the hotel room brushing her teeth? The way he like tracks in when the drug starts to hit her. I don't know. It just really kind of captures what that feeling could really be like. It was just really enjoyable to watch. I thought it was really smart. And I guess it kind of relates to Sunset Boulevard because they actually talk about real people. You know, they reference, what was it, the John Malkovich movie?
Being John Malkovich.
And then also in Sunset Boulevard, who's the director, Cecil B. DeMille, who actually plays himself.
And he's doing Samson and Delilah in the movie.
Right.
Which
right.
is the movie he was actually directing at the time that Sunset Boulevard was made.
I mean, it's sometimes hard. I guess as a screenwriter, you know, some people always tell you to write about what you know. And I guess there's a lot of filmmakers who do write films about films. And sometimes it doesn't always come out great, but I think these two are really good. You know, they stand the test of time and are still really interesting. They found an interesting way to write about film.
I think that in many ways he pulled a rabbit out of the hat with this.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he had this book. I mean, he was supposed to adapt The Orchid Thief. That was his assignment, and he couldn't do it. So he wrote this movie about someone trying to write a movie about a book that can't be turned into a movie. And he thought his career was over. He didn't tell anybody he was doing it this way. He didn't tell the producers that this is what he was doing. And he thought when he turned in the screenplay that his career was going to be over. But Spike Jones loved the script. Kaufman just really pulled a rabbit out of the hat. I can't say he made a silk purse out of a sow's ear because I can't really call the book a sow's ear. But he took something impossible and created something very unique and original.
Yeah, I would agree. I just can't believe they let him make this version, you know?
I think if you asked Charles Kaufman, he would probably say he still doesn't believe it.
Yeah.
Because he thought, this is going to be it. They're never going to do this and they're never going to ask me to do anything ever again. Something that probably just never happens, and it just happened to happen here. What do you think of the portrayal of Robert McKee?
It's interesting. You know, I was given that book. I think I read maybe a couple chapters. Yeah, it's such a big book. I thought it was funny. I don't know what he's like in real life. So I was kind of curious. Is that really how? Because, you know, he was being so, I think his personality may have been augmented. Because, you know, like how Nicolas Cage asks a question, a fair question, and then he kind of like goes off on him. I was curious. Is that what he's like?
I've never been to a seminar of his and I've never read the book. I do know that Robert McKee was asked, who would you like to play him? He said Brian Cox. And so they did hire Brian Cox for the role. I think that what he is supposed to say, or what people say that McKee says, may not always be quite so consistent with what he really does say. I think there's a disconnect. That's the feeling I get between what he says and between what people says he says. This is definitely Charles Kaufman's view of what McKee is like. Okay. And I think McKee has only said that the main area he disagrees with is that he's never said don't use voiceover narrative. He just doesn't like the way a lot of people use it.
I would have to agree. I saw a movie recently that had voiceover and it was not used very well and it just really ruined the film for me. I don't want to say, I forgot what it was even, but even in my film, in my first feature film, How to Win at Checkers, I also used voiceover and it is definitely easier to have voiceover because it's something that you can just, even after you make the movie, you're able to rewrite it, redo it, themes can change. So you're able to remold your themes. So it's definitely a crutch. But in this film, they did use it really well.
And they also used it in Sunset Boulevard.
I mean, I really like the discussion, like I said earlier, between the twins about love. I really like the scenes with Tilda and then just small ones when like Catherine Keener is in my house. I don't know, just really small dialogue was really smart too. I think they said something like, if I almost died, I would leave my marriage too. And he's like, why? Because I could, because it's like a free pass. Nobody could judge you if you almost died. I didn't like the car accident. And third act, I'm not like too crazy about. What about you? What were some of your opinions?
I will say, I think that you are to a degree right about the third act. I think that has always been one of the issues with the movie that critics have pointed out. And I think when I did see it, I did feel like he didn't quite pull it off. He sort of came close, but it was a bit of a
tonal shift.
Letdown. Yeah, it didn't quite work. I understand why he did it. I think it works the best it can under the circumstances. But I think a lot of people at the time said, even though he gives the audience what they want in act three, it doesn't quite work. And that may be why it falls a little short for me as much as I like it.
Yeah, I guess the tonally just shifted so to a totally different movie almost because, you know, the crocodile and the death and how it was killed.
I love the Robert McKee scene. And I also love it because when Robert McKee starts talking about people have to change or there has to be conflict or there has to be this or there has to be that, I do think of films by Michelangelo Antonioni and existentialist films where the conflict is there, but it's very, very subtle that it's almost impossible to see. And you have movies like Amacord and Last Year at Marienbad. There are conflicts there, but it's not quite the same type of film. I do know that McKee is a huge fan of like Ingmar Bergman. I think McKee considers Ingmar Bergman to be the greatest filmmaker, or at least the greatest writer-director. Bergman, in many ways, is very antithetical to American filmmakers and the kind of films that Americans make. So I did find that interesting that even though McKee seems to say all these things, because I don't know for a fact, he's not quite so restrictive. There are a lot of movies I think he probably likes that may not quite fit. Or that he may think there are two kinds of movies. You know, they're the ones with big plots, big character arcs and conflicts. And then there are the more European art films that are more quiet and more restrained. And they're both very worthy. They're just very different.
Yeah, I guess off of that and talking about just screenwriting advice, some of the rules people say, I think, you know, maybe they are there sometimes because it can help. And if you want to look at a majority of the films, maybe there is a villain. And having a villain there definitely creates conflict. But this doesn't mean that every film has to, like, there are definitely films that work without a villain. Maybe the character does. I mean, most films have characters that change, but I've seen films as well where the character doesn't change as much, but still a very good film. So maybe they're there because the majority of the films that they benefit from for a reason, but it doesn't mean that every film has to.
What do you think of Kaufman's other films?
Being John Malkovich, Eternal Sunshine. I think he's a really smart writer, very quirky. I forgot who played the poacher. Yes, it made me fall in love with him again. I guess maybe at that time, having, what was it, the twin in one thing might have been like interesting VFX-wise. Yeah, it's great that he's experimenting and trying new things. And
I do understand that some of the body doubles for Nicolas Cage was his cousin.
Whose cousin? Nicolas Cage's cousin?
Yes, he's a Coppola. I can't remember exactly which Coppola. Okay. There are so many of them. I think he bears a resemblance to Nicolas Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage was not the first choice. Tom Hanks was actually, about to be signed for the role. I don't know why he pulled it out or why that was changed.
I'm glad Nicolas Cage did it. He's more neurotic, which I think writers can be. And I think the writing process can make writers neurotic sometimes.
Chris Cooper took a very long time to cast him because I think they were going through everybody. And Chris Cooper was not a big enough name.
Oh.
But they finally did. He stole the show. He got the Oscar. I like the scenes at the film shoot where nobody looks at Charlie Kaufman.
Yeah.
And nobody pays him any attention. He's the least important person on the set. But one of the ironies is nobody says Spike Jonze's adaptation. They always say Charlie Kaufman's adaptation.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's true.
And that's very rare.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was Spike Jonze until I was like looking up information about this. I almost felt like the writing might have dictated a lot of things. And just the writing is so smart.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think that the writing so elevates the story. And Charles Kaufman has such a unique way of writing and vision that people remember that he's the one who comes up with these ideas.
And maybe it's also because it's a movie about a writer instead of a director. And then maybe that's another reason why people might gravitate to him more than Spike Jonze.
And he also put himself in the movie.
I haven't talked to anybody about this movie. You're the first person I've actually talked to about this movie. So I wanted to know, am I interpreting? I mean, like, I guess it's open to interpretation, but they're actually one person, the twins?
It's a real person. For one thing, he sells a screenplay that's going to get made. He writes the screenplay 3. It's sold. I don't think it's supposed to be Charlie Kaufman wrote both screenplays.
It could be like, I have a writer's block on this one, so I'm going to write another screenplay. And actually that one is sold. And why can't you write more screenplays like this?
Well, no, it's certainly possible. And I can't argue against it. That movie that he writes is about a character that has a split personality and is very reminiscent of a movie called Identity with John Cusack, where there's a big surprise ending where all the characters, 6 or 7 characters, are all actually John Cusack.
I didn't see this one.
It's not a particularly good movie. It's interesting for a while until about 15 minutes in, I go, oh, I get it. They're all John Cusack. Movie over.
Okay.
And I think it is interesting. The one area that I sort of identify with is that Charlie Kaufman is really having issues with writing the screenplay and wants to write a good screenplay, doesn't want to write a standard formulaic screenplay that he's only writing to make money and that the studios want to make money off of. And then, of course, his brother comes along and writes the screenplay with no problem really whatsoever and immediately sells it. So I will finish the segment on adaptation with a few more facts. It got 4 Academy Award nominations for actor, supporting actor, supporting actress, and adapted screenplay. It won supporting actor for Chris Cooper, and it won the BAFTA for best adapted screenplay. Susan Orlean, who wrote the book The Orchid Thief, was quite taken aback and aghast at the screenplay when she saw it and didn't really want to give her permission for it to be done. But when everybody else started saying how much they liked the screenplay, then she decided to do it. And she said it did take her for a while to like the movie.
Oh, did they meet in real life?
Only after the movie was made. There was, I think, a time when they were going to meet, but sort of like in the movie, he sort of panicked and left.
Wow. Okay. I want to clarify, you had asked me, do you think this movie stands the test of time? Mm-hmm. And I will say, like, when I went back and watched it, I did enjoy it again, but it's not as good as the movie you recommended, your classic choice.
Oh, Sunset Boulevard. I will have to agree with that, and we'll certainly get into that. So, you've actually given us a great segue to talk about my choice, which was Sunset Boulevard. To begin with a few facts about the movie, it was released in 1950. It was directed and co-written by Billy Wilder. It was co-written and produced by Charles Brackett. The music is by Franz Waxman, and it stars William Holden, Gloria Swanson, Eric von Stroheim, Nancy Olson, Ned Clark, Lloyd Gow, Jack Webb, and as themselves, Cecil B. DeMille, Hedda Hopper, Buster Keaton, Anna Q. Nelson, H.B. Warner. The basic premise revolves a down-on-his-luck screenwriter who, while avoiding some repo men, finds himself at the mansion of a once-famous silent film star. He is hired by her to work on her script for her big comeback, and tragedy ensues. So when did you first see Sunset Boulevard?
I saw it, I think, in my 20s after I graduated college. My uncle, he's really into movies. He actually studied film. When I went to his house, we watched it together. It's a really... I would say after having rewatched it all these years, I think it's just such a perfect ending. Even the character makes good choices. Since I didn't really go to film school, my uncle was someone who really gave me this kind of classic film education. He really was into movies, so he would give me the backstories of silent films. I think he said something about how people, because when I was watching it, I was remembering my uncle maybe told me about this, of how, who is it that was like a really famous silent film actor, but then once they started acting, you know, like speaking, people were kind of shocked because it wasn't the voice
The most famous one is John Gilbert.
Okay.
He was a very famous, very big silent film star, often with Greta Garbo, but he also had a drinking problem and he had personal problems. And then when he made his first sound film, his voice was a bit too thin and I think high pitched. But there is also some indication, or some people say, that the studio wanted to get rid of him.
Oh.
He was too much trouble. He was too big a drinker. So they sort of use this as an excuse to get rid of
him. But it wasn't just him. Like, it was a lot of actors, right? So did they use this as an excuse to get rid of excess baggage?
Sometimes, yes. A lot of actors very easily made the transition. Okay. Greta Garbo. And they worked with them to help them make the transition, because they had all these actors. They made money for them. They weren't just going to immediately dump them, and they really worked to try to keep them going if they felt it was worth it. John Gilbert, who was very problematic, did not make the transition, and I think they sort of used that as a way to get rid of him. However, John Barrymore, who I'm not sure made a lot of silent films, he was even more problematic than John Gilbert, yet they did keep him on because he was such an incredibly great actor.
I feel like, because when I was watching it, they could have, like, you know, re-recorded the sound. They're going to have to re-record the sound anyways. They could just reuse some. If they really wanted to keep this actor, they could have hired another, you know, voice actor to, like, a more masculine voice, or, you know, voice.
It was very difficult. When Alfred Hitchcock did Blackmail, he was doing both a silent and sound version at the same time. But the female lead was German, and she had a very thick accent. And he came up with the first solution to dubbing.
I didn't know that.
So he had an actress off camera speaking the lines for the lead actress, who just mouthed them.
Who is this?
Alfred Hitchcock was the one who, I can't remember the name of the actress, but that's how he dubbed that, because he knew there was going to be a problem. Singing in the Rain, the whole basis is that they were able to dub in. They could have, but then they would have to keep on doing that. And he was an alcoholic and problematic, so they just wanted to get rid of him. Actually, let's get into that later, because that's a very good point, and it's something I did actually was thinking of bringing up. So I eventually do want to talk about that, but let's get into that a little bit later. So you said that you liked the film very much. Do you think it still holds up? How did you feel about it on your new viewing?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's such a good movie. The writing is really good. Acting is really good. William Holden, he's like so charming. And his acting is so great. You know, his expressions, and police are in the room. They're like being not nasty to him, but they're being hard, giving him a hard time. And he's like, as a salutation, he's like, you guys say the cutest things. It's a lot of the lines.
This is what Billy Wilder was known for as well, with his various co-writers. This one was Charles Brackett, but he also used I.A.L. Diamond and some other people. He was known for this kind of really hard-nosed, witty banter.
And it was also really, funny, because it was Eric von Stroheim who plays the servant, her husband.
Max von Meyerling.
William Holden goes up the stairs, and Max, the servant, is like, if you need any help with the coffin, call me. And I don't know, I just laughed out loud. There's some really small moments that were really funny. So I don't know, I really enjoyed it. I would say that my favorite scene was the one where she goes to the Paramount Studios and goes to see Cecil B. DeMille. That whole scene was really well done, and it was just really interesting to watch.
Yes, it's full of subtext, because nobody's actually talking about what they're really talking about.
Yeah.
I first saw it when I was in, I believe, either junior high or my first year of high school. It was a Saturday night. I remember it very specifically, because I really wasn't feeling all that well. So I was at home and I was doing nothing. I just happened to turn the television on just the very second that the movie started. And it begins with this person in the swimming pool who begins to narrate his life. And I couldn't stop watching it. I was just really drawn in. I was beginning to become more interested in movies at the time that I saw this, but I hadn't really been seeing a lot of the, I guess, more adult, grown-up classic movies. Most of my movies tended to be movies that I would see when I went to the kids' matinee at the local movie theater on Saturday morning, where it was mainly Hammer horror films, Japanese monster films, or Sword and Sandal epics, or Saturday afternoon, where they had a lot of these both terrible and good sci-fi and horror films. And this is probably one of the very first great films that I ever had an immediate reaction to, and said, this is a really good film. And it wasn't the kind of film that I normally watched at the time.
Did it make you want to be a writer?
That actually wasn't what made me want to be a writer. Something else that happened later on. I went to see a local production of Sound of Music. And when I saw that, I said, I want to write plays.
Okay.
The irony is that I can't stand The Sound of Music today. I think it's an awful, awful musical. The movie is better than the play, but it's a terrible, terrible play. But that's the one that actually got me into wanting to write. How does the movie sort of speak to you as a filmmaker and a writer?
It does like show, like, because, you know, he's part of a writing community. And I thought that was definitely what was interesting is you get to meet all these interesting people when you do film, these actors, actresses with just a whole bunch of money, or studio executives with a whole bunch of money. Then, you know, the struggling writer and they're with ambitious dreams. I did think it kind of captured that sort of community, all of it, the whole film industry, in a way I could relate and in a way that I kind of knew of.
To a certain degree, it has the same attitude toward the screenwriter, both in this one and Charlie Kaufman. The screenwriter isn't treated very well. Yet at the same time, in many ways, they're actually treated the most important part of the movie. They write the screenplay. If you don't have a screenplay, there's nothing there. There's no movie to make. And William Holden, I think, has a line that says something like, most people think that nobody writes these movies, that the actors make up the dialogue as they go along. So they're treated very badly, but they're the unsung hero of movies at the same time. I find the openings especially very interesting because the openings take place where I actually live, in Hollywood.
Oh, okay.
And his apartment is up a hill just east of me. I can't remember the name of the apartment now, but if I go up that hill, which I sometimes do if I'm going to the store or something, I will pass by the apartment complex that he lived in the movie, which is where a lot of writers and people in the industry lived at the time. I recognize like the parking lot where he hides his car. I think that's still there. I recognize some of the streets, but you also notice that he goes down streets and there's nothing there, and you really don't find those streets anymore. Those streets are pretty much crowded and
built. Yeah, thinking about that, I think he was like turning left on one street, maybe trying to escape from the police or something. I was like, well, where in LA can you see that kind of street now?
Right, especially of course on Sunset Boulevard. Yeah, the repo men are following him, the people that want his car, and that's when he turns into the Mansion area. And even though that's supposed to be on Sunset Boulevard, it apparently wasn't filmed there. It was a film someplace else. The mansion itself, they rented the outside of it. I think inside they shot that inside of Studio Centenary. And the fee for them to rent the place was to build the swimming pool, because apparently there wasn't a swimming pool there.
Oh, I heard it was like a Getty house.
Getty did buy it, and okay. I think they owned it for about 3 years, and they might have been the one that actually rented it to them. This location was used in Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh.
When the three teens run off to this big mansion, at one point they're sitting in a swimming pool. Mm. This is the swimming pool that they're sitting in.
Okay.
It is one of the great American films, and Billy Wilder is definitely one of the greatest American filmmakers, and it is, has withstood the test of time. It has other similarities to adaptation. Both of them have real people in them, not just Cecil B. DeMille and Hedda Hopper, but the three bridge partners, Lester Keaton, who was a great film comedian, who found that comedians had the hardest time making the transition because comedians in silent films were mainly visual comedians. Once you bring sound in, you don't want them to be so visual anymore. They had the hardest time making the transition, and he had a very difficult time making a living. Anna Q. Nielsen was an actress who decided to retire. H.B. Warner, I thought, was the oddest addition because he had a very successful career. His last movie was The Ten Commandments. He was in It's a Wonderful Life. He was in Lost Horizon. I think it was a last minute replacement. I think they had someone else and that person bowed out. So at the last minute, they got H.B. Warner. So both films actually use real people.
If you were in that, if you're in his position, what would you have done? Would you have stayed with the rich woman? Would you have gone with the girl you seemingly are falling for? Would you have gone back home?
It's hard for me to say. I have a feeling that I might have stayed for a while. And finally, I said no. Once I realized that the screenplay was never going to get made, okay. And once I wasn't being paid, because he says at one time, he's supposed to be getting $500 a week, but he's not getting any money. He says all of his needs provided for, and he's being paid for everything. I suspect that after a while, I would have said no, or I would have been just working on my own screenplay at night and pretty much ignoring what she wanted until I would get thrown out because I really wasn't working on her screenplay.
Okay.
I don't know. What do you think? What would you have done?
I don't know. I think I'd be tempted to go out with the girl, go out with the love. But of course, you know, you're cheating on your best friend's girlfriend, so maybe not.
I think that is an interesting relationship. He tries not to fall in love with her. And then when he does try to stay away from her. She becomes to realize that she's not really as in love with her boyfriend as she thinks she is. I do think that sort of brings up an interesting side issue here, and that is the movie that they're writing. And I always thought it was funny. The more I see it, I just keep thinking, God, what a terrible movie they're writing.
Okay, I have a question. Was Gloria Swanson, was she that overacting? She act like that in other movies?
No, she was actually more restrained.
Okay.
In other movies. This is the acting decision she made. And apparently she stayed in character throughout the whole movie. And she would go home with her daughter and she would still be Norma Desmond at home.
Wow.
Apparently the very last day of shooting, after everything was done, that was it. She completely went back to being Gloria Swanson.
Okay.
But wow. She was one of the most successful silent film stars of the day, and she did try to make the transition. She made a movie with Laurence Olivier, and it has some nice moments, but it's not very well written, and it doesn't really work. But this is an area where we can get in as to how accurate or how fair this movie might be, because she chose to retire. It wasn't the studio that pushed her out. And it's true taste has changed, but she didn't try to stay and find a way to connect with the audience again. But at the same time, she didn't bury herself away in a mansion. She did sort of retire from show business for 9 years, but then she went to the stage, she went to radio, and she went to television. And this happened for a lot of these actresses. Mary Pickford did find that taste changed. She was always played this sort of sweet young thing, and she was getting way too old to play it. She stayed around in sound films long enough to win an Oscar, and then decided that she didn't want to change and become the kind of actress that she needed to become in pre-code Hollywood. Taste really changed in pre-code Hollywood. They didn't want naive, young, innocent actresses anymore, except perhaps for Shirley Temple, if they were children. But pre-code Hollywood was much edgier, much more darker. So finally she did retire, and she did go back to her house, and she never really became involved in show business again.
I was just trying to imagine what it would be like to have seen it in the cinema, because, you know, there's that final line, you know, towards the end, and it's like she says, it's just us and the cameras. And then she looks at the camera and those wonderful people out there in the dark. And when she said that, I was just, it just put me like in the seat of a cinema, and I was just thinking, wow, this would have been so wonderful to have seen this movie in the cinema.
I have seen it on the big screen. It is beautiful to look at. It has that rich black and white cinematography at the time. When it came to the late 50s, that changed because TV was coming in and the studios wanted their movies to be able to be shown on TV. The dark, contrasting, moody, deep black and white of the 40s and early 50s didn't look as good on television. So at the end of the 1950s, you start getting a lot of films that are in black and white, but that sort of have a flat, uninteresting look to them. They don't have this, what they often call film noir type of cinematography.
Okay. Which reminds me of black and white films. Fellini, 8.5. That is another film about film that is one of my favorite movies. It's about an Italian filmmaker who is working on a science fiction film, which I'm working on now. I don't know. I think that was one movie that also really got me interested in cinema and made me start to want to become a filmmaker.
It's a very interesting movie. I have trouble with the film, and I think my big problem with it is it starts in the middle of Act One, and so I have a hard time figuring out what's going on, what his problem is. Sort of once you figure out what's going on, it becomes more and more interesting. It's a very interesting transition movie for Fellini. For me, what 8.5 sort of says is that Fellini was running out of ideas, and he didn't know what movies to make. I believe this was set after La Dolce Vita, which I think is his greatest film. And the conclusion at the very end is that he decides to go into his past. And after this movie, some of the films he starts to make are more films about not just his past, like Armacord. It's also Fellini's Satyricon. It's about Italy's past. Fellini's Roma is sort of a kind of semi-documentary about modern-day Rome and films like that. And so he found a way to keep on going and keep on making films. And I think 8.5 is transition from running out of ideas to finding a way to make movies again, to find new ideas. But it's also interesting that also, like in Sunset Boulevard, the movie that he's making seems seems to be a rather silly movie.
Yeah.
That is so often true in a lot of these films. If you see Day for Night, which is the greatest film about making movies, as far as I'm concerned, and movies like Irma Vep and Contempt, the movies are great, but the movies that they're making within the movies, you sort of think, why are they making these movies? They don't seem to be very good movies.
Oh, that's true. I guess adaptation, the movie he's writing, is kind of interesting.
That seems to be one of the exceptions, even though the book is impossible to adapt and has no plot. So from that perspective, you might wonder, why is anybody making a movie out of this book? He manages to find a way to do it, to make a film that's actually kind of worth making. So in that way, the story within the story, the film within the film, yes, is a much more interesting film than the one that they're writing in Sunset Boulevard or the one they're making in these other films. The casting of the movie Sunset Boulevard is actually very interesting because Gloria Swanson was the fourth choice to play Norma Desmond. And I know I don't remember the three before that, but one was Mary Pickford, who became very offended at the idea of playing this role.
Okay.
Mae West, who was insulted at the idea that she needed to make a comeback. She said no one would believe that she was old enough for the role. And I think another actress also just found it offensive.
Okay.
And Gloria Swanson did want to do it. It was George Cukor's idea. They said to use Gloria Swanson. And Gloria Swanson was interested in doing it, but they wanted her to do a screen test. And she was furious.
Oh, wow.
Because she said, I built Paramount Studios. I'm responsible for the success of Paramount Studios.
Oh, yeah.
I made all these great movies, and they want me to do a screen test. And Cukor said, this is the movie you're going to be remembered for. So do the screen test. If you don't do this movie, I'll shoot you.
It feels like that kind of line is in the movie.
It feels like something Billy Wilder and Charles Bracken would actually write. And she did the movie, and it is the movie that she is most remembered for. It didn't really restart her career because she kept getting offers of roles that were too much like Norma Desmond. So she basically went back to TV and radio and only did a couple of other movies. William Holden was at least the third choice. The first choice was Montgomery Clift, who I think had even signed to do it. But he was in a relationship with a torch singer called Libby Holman, I believe at the time, who was much older than he was. And she felt that the story was much too close to theirs and threatened to kill herself if he did the movie.
Wow.
So he withdrew. He also said something to Billy Wilder about he had just done a movie with Olivia de Havilland called The Heiress, where he was asked to kiss and make love to an older woman, and he said he didn't want to do that again.
Okay.
The second choice was Fred McMurray, and he didn't really want to do it because he had done Double Indemnity, and he sort of felt the role was a bit too close to that one, and he didn't want to repeat himself. And William Holden was a risk because he wasn't that big a name at the time. He had a nice debut with Golden Boy, but his films didn't do well, and he had a drinking problem. But they finally went with him, and then he does this great performance, and because of this, he becomes a major star, and Billy Wilder uses him for a few more movies.
Yeah, he was great. He was perfect for this role.
The original way it was supposed to open at a morgue, mm-hmm. and the various bodies are talking to each other about how they got there. William Holden gets rolled in, and they ask him how he got there, and he starts telling the story from the morgue. But when they tried that with preview audiences, mm-hmm. the preview audiences started laughing.
You mean like he would open his eyes?
No, I don't think so, but he was just, his corpse was talking in the morgue, and the audience just started laughing at that. So they took a couple of months to come up with a new beginning, and that's with him being in the swimming pool. And it was difficult shot because Billy Wilder wanted a very clear picture of William Holden face down with the police and press seen through the water, and they didn't really have the cameras for that.
Oh.
So they put a mirror at the bottom of the pool
uh-huh.
and shot the reflection in the mirror.
Was the camera in the water then?
No. They shot it through the water.
Wow. But
they shot the reflection from the mirror at the bottom of the water.
That's really smart.
I think today they have the cameras and everything they can do that.
Right.
This is one of my favorite American movies, and it's certainly in my top 100 movies. Some other facts about the movie. It got 11 Oscar nominations.
Oh, wow.
Picture, director, actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress, black and white cinematography, editing. It won story and screenplay. It won art direction for black and white, and it won scoring, the fabulous music by Fran Waxman. That year was the same year as All About Eve. So people expected either Gloria Swanson or Bette Davis, two NBEST actress. Bette Davis and Gloria Swanson, the roles they played this year, are two of the greatest pieces of acting in American film history. In addition, All About Eve also had a leading actress nomination for Anne Baxter. So none of them won. It went to Judy Holliday for Born Yesterday, a comedy that is a very enjoyable film, also with William Holden. Judy Holliday is hysterical in it. She's quite great. But it is one of the years where the right person did not win. Bette Davis won Cannes for her performance, and Gloria Swanson won a couple of the Critics Awards for Best Actress. It did well in the big cities, but it didn't do well in what they call the sticks. It was sort of like Citizen Kane in that way. I don't think it lost many, but it didn't really do very well. The studio head at the time, when they showed the film for the studios and for actors and actresses at studio screenings, one of them came up and yelled at Billy Wilder for what he called biting the hand that fed him. Mm-hmm. And apparently Billy Wilder said something like, F you, and just walked off.
Why do you think this film didn't do well in the sticks?
Oh, it's an art film. Okay. It's not something that really appeals to people in small towns. There actually were what you might call art films and big studio films at the time. Yeah, films like Sunset Boulevard weren't going to do all that well in small towns. Citizen Kane didn't do well in small towns for a variety of reasons, but also because it's an art film. And we have that same problem today. So in closing, I did ask you to come up with a movie or two that you might want to recommend for people in the same vein or similar to adaptation.
Yeah, I mentioned this earlier, Fellini's Eight and a Half. I really like that personally, and it's something I need to rewatch as well.
It's certainly a wonderful film. It's certainly one of his greatest films, and a lot of people consider it one of the greatest films about filmmaking. And there's Marcello Mastroianni in it, so that always helps. My choice will be a movie called In a Lonely Place, directed by Nicholas Ray. It stars Humphrey Bogart and Gloria Graham, and it is about a screenwriter who has not written a screenplay in some time. He tends to get into a lot of fights, drinks a bit too much, and has been known to be in abusive relations with women in the past. He gets assigned to adapt a book, but at the same time, a hat check girl that he meets ends up dead, and he becomes the chief suspect. It's considered one of the classic film noirs. I think it's one of Humphrey Bogart's greatest performances.
I'll look into it. It looks good.
So to conclude, what is next? What are you working on now, or what should we be expecting?
So, like Fellini in Eight and a Half, I'm working on a sci-fi film, a bigger budget sci-fi film. It's been taking some time, but It's based on a Hugo Award-winning novella called Folding Beijing. It imagines a futuristic city where all the buildings in the city fold and go underground, and the population is separated by class into three different spaces. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on right now.
It's a great idea, and I'm very much looking forward to it.
Thank you.
For me, I will go over my usual litany that I go in every week. I'm a screenwriter and script consultant. I have a script consultation page on Facebook called Howard Kasner Screenplay Consultation. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about screenwriting and movies. I have published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are horror, sci-fi, and fantasy short stories. I published the second edition of my screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader. I've become an amateur photographer. You can find that on Instagram. Last week, Pop Art covered the movies Aliens and Attack the Block. And next week, my guest will be Ann Kimbrough, a filmmaker and producer, and we will be talking about Die Hard and District D13.
Oh, cool.
And I should also point out that your film, How to Win at Checkers Every Time, is available to be seen on Amazon.
Yes. Thank you.
So thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
Thank you. This was really fun. I'm going to check out In a Lonely Place, but actually it was really great to be able to rewatch some of these films. I hadn't seen them like in maybe 20 years. So yes, thank you, Howard.
That's one thing too. Sometimes I haven't seen some of these films in ages, and now I get to see them again. And that can be a lot of fun. Thanks again. ¶¶